This is our review in our Every Day with God series for Sunday, June 7th, the PM session. Again, Sunday, June 7th, this is the review that we would normally do during our PM Bible study. We're reading through Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther the last week and into this week. If you have your daily Bible reading schedule in front of you, you will note that at the end of May, which was Sunday, May 31st, we finished Ezra 6, 7, and 8. And so starting at June 1st, Monday, we took up with Ezra chapter 9, verse 1 and following, and finished the reading through chapter 10. And then we get into the book of Nehemiah. Through the week, which would conclude on Sunday the 7th, we will be up to Esther chapter 3. And so we started our review with Ezra 9. We finished Ezra and got into Nehemiah chapter 1, 2, 3, and 4. So we're going to take up at Nehemiah chapter 5, and continue through Esther, the first three chapters. So let me encourage you, if you have your Bibles handy or your notes, to take up there. Let me grab my Bible. It's right here. And let's move forward. So looking at our handout for Nehemiah chapter 5, first five verses of the chapter, we note the problems that were caused among the people because of debt, interest, bondage, usury, and so forth. The rich were taking advantage of the poor. And Nehemiah had something to say about that, obviously. Nehemiah saw to it that that practice was abolished, starting in verse 6 of the chapter. He spoke to the nobles, those who would have been more wealthy, more prominent among the people, and he encouraged them to discontinue their practices of levying, that is, charging so much interest. The nobles agreed, and at Nehemiah's directive, they restored the lands and the monies which they had acquired from the poor. So if somebody finds themselves in some disadvantaged state for whatever circumstance, physical illness in their lives or the lives of somebody else, death or something else like that, some tragedy or some accident befalls them, all of a sudden there's money that has to be laid out to make whatever happened right again, to fix the problem, to correct whatever the issue might have been, to recover from the accident. And so now they become financially disadvantaged. So they may need resources. So it's easy for somebody who has plenty of resources to step in and to be offering to help them, but at gain for themselves. Well, yes, I see that you're out X amount of dollars. I'll be glad to loan that to you at some exorbitant amount of interest. And so those who had were taking advantage of those who did not have. So they made an oath that they would not do that as they had done again, and they followed through on their promise. Final section of the chapter demonstrates something about the character of Nehemiah. First, remember that as the cupbearer to the king, where he was before, King Artaxerxes, he was in a position of prominence and a position of influence. He requested of the king to be allowed to return, to come to the land of Judah, in order to help the people in the rebuilding of the walls of the city. And he became the governor of the land. He's appointed the governor. He didn't draw wages and didn't live on the luxuries that his position as a governor would normally allow. But rather, he lived on what was necessary so that the work's not going to be hindered, and because of his fear, that is, his respect of the Lord. In this notable example, there's a lesson for all of us. So if you look through the chapter, chapter 5, people come out and to Nehemiah and they let him know, listen, we've mortgaged our houses, we've mortgaged our lands, we've mortgaged our vineyards so we can buy grain because there's a famine. And we've borrowed money in order to pay taxes on the lands and the vineyards. And we're adversely affected because of this. You know, we didn't cause this famine. We didn't make any of these bad things to happen. And so we can't pay back what we had to borrow because the interest rates are so incredibly high. And so Nehemiah realizes the nobles, the rulers, are exacting usury. Verse 7, that means they're charging interest. And the interest is such that it's unbearable to the people who have been disadvantaged through these circumstances. So he says, listen, we need to do something about that. He says, you are taking advantage of your Jewish brethren. We were sold to the nations. We've come back, and now you're buying us up again. You're taking advantage of us. That's not fair. What you're doing isn't good. Don't do this. And so he says, restore to these people their lands and their properties and their monies and so forth, and make sure that you don't do this again. And the people acknowledged that they were wrong, and so they returned the properties and so forth, and everything's fine. And then the last part, verses 14 and following, we see that Nehemiah says, even though I was a governor of the king Artaxerxes, I didn't eat the governor's provisions. That is, I didn't take what I could have taken. All the former governors, this is what they did. They had all kinds of stuff, everything they could possibly want, and money besides. He says, but I didn't do that. So he says that once in verse 14, again in verse 15, I'm not going to do that. And he says, I was not going to take the governor's provisions because, notice verse 18, the bondage was heavy on this people. How fair would it have been to Nehemiah, who had the right to live in luxury as the governor while he was trying to help people who were doing without? Yeah, it's easy for you to help us. You got everything you need. And so he was sympathetic to their plight, wanted those who were able to take advantage of them not to do so, and said, listen, I've got a position of influence. I could do better than what I'm doing now, but I don't want to do that. I want to identify with the people. I want to be able to help them. I want to be able to demonstrate that I am an example that's consistent with what I'm asking you to do. Don't take advantage of anybody else. All right, chapter 6. The work continues on the walls of the rebuilding of the city of Jerusalem. The opposition is not getting any weaker. In fact, it's getting stronger. It grows more and more determined to stop the work. Opening part of the chapter, we learn that Sanballat sent messengers to Nehemiah 4 times. So they're not just asking, hey, stop this, stop this. They 4 times. They ask him to come out to the villages in the plain of Ono to meet together so that they can, you know, encourage him to stop what he was doing. Verse 4 tells us, these verses tell us that Sanballat thought to do some harm to Nehemiah to make sure he stops. And so the 5th time, Sanballat sends a letter saying he's heard that the Jews were going to rebel and they're going to make Nehemiah their king. No such truth to that, but hey, it sounds good. These people are building a wall. They're going to rebuild the great city of Jerusalem. They're going to be like the former kings, David and Solomon, dominate the world. And that's what Nehemiah wants. He wants to become their king. And that's why they're building the wall. No truth to that. So Nehemiah informed them that these were only the imaginations of Sanballat's heart. Not the first time we've seen something like that. Jeroboam devised these things in his own heart. 1 Kings chapter 12. Later, Shemaiah sought to influence Nehemiah to hide in the temple to save his life, but Nehemiah refused. Later, we're told that Shemaiah was hired by Tobiah and Sanballat to do this thing that they might catch Nehemiah in doing something wrong. Not supposed to go hiding in the temple. So all of those attempts fail. So notice there's a huge amount of pressure being put on Nehemiah to give up this project of rebuilding the city of Jerusalem. Last section of the chapter, we learn that the wall around the city was finished in 52 days. When the enemies of the people of the city learned about this accomplishment, they're cast down. They realize, you know, God's hand must have been involved in this. And the last 2 verses, we learn that some of the nobles of Judah were related to Tobiah and were therefore influenced by him. And so the conspiracy to stop, and maybe not such a hidden conspiracy, but out in the open in some measure, was complicated by some not out in the open conspiracy by means of relatives who were connected to Tobiah. So they're rebuilding the wall. They challenge him to meet multiple times, sent messengers multiple times. He's not going to do this, not going to come out to you. In verse 8, the passage we noticed before, I told him, said, listen, that's not what's going on here. You're just flat making these things up. You invent them in your own heart, he says. So afterward, he came to the house of Shemaiah, the son of Deliah, the son of Mahatabeel, and it was a secret informer, and said, let's meet together in the house of God, in the temple. Let's go in there, and because they might come to kill you. So he's trying to get him to do something wrong, going inside the confines of the temple where he wasn't supposed to be. But we see that's part of a plot. So all of this is to get Nehemiah to stop doing what he's doing. You're leaving us out of the process that we wanted to be a part of back during the days of Zerubbabel, and you're not letting us be part of that. You know, we don't want you you to complete this this wall. We don't want you to complete the city. And that's in part connected to their desire to make sure that the worship of Jehovah God wasn't going to be carried out, because they've been claiming that they've been worshiping God since the beginning, going back to such and such a time. And so this is an indictment against what they were doing religiously. So they finally give up, realize that God's involved in this work, and then we see the complicit nature of the nobles in Judah. Many in Judah were pledged to him because he's the son-in-law of Shechaniah, the son of Ara'ah, and his son Jehonan had married the daughter of Meshulam, the son of Berechiah. Also, they reported his good deeds before me and reported my words to him, and Tobias sent letters to frighten me. So that's the whole point, tried to scare him off. All right, chapter 7, first part of the chapter just details the appointment of the rulers over the different parts of the city of Jerusalem. And then the last part of the chapter goes through the names of all of those people who had been part of the returning exile. So it's a long section going from chapter 7, verse 5 through the end of the chapter, verse 73. So a huge portion of that chapter devoted to that, 69 verses. So when the wall was built, he hung the doors, the gatekeepers, the singers, the Levites had been appointed. Then he gave charge to Jerusalem, to these different individuals and so forth. City's large and spacious, but the people in it were few and the houses were not rebuilt. So walls are done, some of the city's done, but everybody's houses on the interior, they're not finished. So now that's another process that needs to be completed. And then we see the register of genealogy starting in verse 5. These are the people who came back from captivity, of those who'd been carried away, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away captive, and who returned, everyone to his own city. And then it begins the list. And Zerubbabel, incidentally, is mentioned at the beginning of that list. All right? So that's demonstrating to us how many people came back from what was then Babylon, what was then under the control of Nebuchadnezzar during the decree of Cyrus. Just a reminder, not everybody comes back. There are a lot of people come back, but remember, we're going to see when we get to Isaiah and Jeremiah, a reference to this has already been made. When we get to those prophets, there's an emphasis on the remnant. All right, chapter 8, we are reading in the book of Nehemiah, but we see a large element of Ezra's role at the same time period. So the first part of the chapter tells us with an account of the reading of the law of the Lord by Ezra to the people who had come back from a period of captivity to rebuild the city of Jerusalem, its walls, and the temple and so forth, and to do this major redo that we mentioned before. So the law was read from morning until midday. The people wept when they heard the law of the Lord read. Notice what it says. Ezra is reading it. I'm looking for the passage. I don't see it. There it is. Verse 5. Ezra opened the book in the sight of all the people, for he's standing above all the people. There's a platform they built. And when he opened it, all the people stood up and responded at the reading, saying, Amen, Amen. So that's an interesting thing, showing deference and reverence for God's work. So the law was read from morning until midday. People, when they heard the law of the Lord read aloud, they wept. The Levites and Ezra and Nehemiah were all involved in teaching the people that they, that is the people, might understand the law. When all the people understood it, they were told to go their way, to eat the fat, drink the sweet of the land, and to send portions to those who had nothing prepared. So if you have, take care of those who have not. People went away and did this because they understood the words that were declared unto them on that day. Such should be the life of the Christian today. We hear God's word, we're convicted by it, we're changed by it, and we live in concert with it. When we understand what the Bible says, we're supposed to live that out in our life. And the last section of the chapter talks about the celebration of the Feast of the Tabernacles among the people of the land who had come back from captivity during this period of restoration. Feast of Tabernacles, one of the three great feasts. There's a feast at the beginning of the year. That's the Feast of Passover, followed 50 days later by the Feast of Pentecost. also called the Feast of Weeks. That's the first harvest, the Passover, and then the last harvest at the end of the year, Feast of the Tabernacles, also called the Feast of Booths. So we know this is later in the Jewish calendar year. So in the seventh month, when they all came together, the people gathered together as one man in verse 1, and they told Ezra the scribe to bring the book of the law of Moses, which may have been just the book of Deuteronomy, which the Lord commanded Israel. So Ezra the priest brought this before the congregation to all those who could hear and understand on the first day of that month. He read from it in the open square that was in front of the water gate from morning until midday. And so that was a long reading. As the light's beginning to dawn, perhaps he starts and he reads continuing into the midday. He read from it there before the men and women and those who could understand, and the ears of all the people were attentive to the book of the law. So Ezra the scribe stood on a platform of wood, which they made for that purpose, so he's elevated from them. And beside him in his right hand stood, and their names are mentioned, Mattathiah, Shema, Ananiah, Urijah, Hilkiah, Maaseiah, and at his left hand, Padiah, Mishael, Malchijah, Hashum, Hashbadana, Zechariah, and Meshullam. He opens the book inside of the people, for he's standing above all the people on this platform. And when he opened it, the people stood. He blessed the Lord, the great God. Then all the people said, Amen, Amen. Lifting up their hands, they bowed their heads and worshiped the Lord with their faces. So all those individuals that were there helped the people to understand the law, and the people stood in their place. They read distinctly from the book and the law and gave the sense and helped them to understand the reading. And so this was part of what Ezra did. Nehemiah was there. The governor, the priests were there in addition to Ezra, saying, this day is holy. Don't mourn, don't weep, for the people wept when they heard the words of the law. You know, be thankful that God has allowed you to live into this day and that you can start all over again. Don't sorrow, for the joy of the Lord is your strength. All right, then the celebration of the Feast of Tabernacles, also referred to as booths in verse 14, takes place in verse 13 and following. Notice in verse 17, so the whole congregation of those who had returned from the captivity made booths, reminiscent of what they did when they lived in tents in the wilderness, and sat under the booths, for since the days of Joshua, the son of Nun, Joshua is the leader after Moses, until that day the children of Israel had not done so, and there was very great gladness. Now that's amazing. Moses lives roughly 1,500 years prior to the time of Christ. Joshua would have followed shortly after that. This is nearly 1,000 years later, and the text says they hadn't done it like this before. Now, I would be careful to say they'd never done it, but it hadn't done it like this anyway. That's mentioned with reference to the Passover that's observed by Josiah. So I have to double check. It may have been that they didn't do it at all. That's a big mistake. And so they read from the book of the law day by day from the first day to the last day. So they didn't just read the first day, they continued, and they kept up the feast for 7 days. So again, remember, this is a huge, huge redo of what they started when they came back from captivity. God has given them the privilege, not just the obligation, but the privilege to be his people all over again. All right, first few verses of the next chapter, chapter 9. People gather together on the day that's prescribed, and they fast. In addition to that, they read in the book of the law of the Lord for part of the day, worship the Lord, and confess the rest of the day that's spelled out in the opening verses. They stood up in their place, read from the book of the law of the Lord, their God, for 1/4 of the day, and for another fourth they confessed and worshiped the Lord, their God. And what we're going to see next is a profession, a confession of their mistakes. Largest part of the chapter, starting in verse 4, depicts the confession of the priests and the Levites, includes a brief history of the children of Israel and all the things which God did for them to help them. And that's a major thing that we see on a regular basis, that God rehearses past history, physical history in which they've been redeemed, which is connected to their spiritual redemption as well. God helps physically, God helps spiritually, demonstrates that he has a good heart, keeps covenant and his righteousness through all these things. So it's notes, for example, you saw our affliction in Egypt, and verse 9, you demonstrated great wonders against Pharaoh and so forth. divided the sea. You spared us. All of these things you did. You made your commandments and statutes known to us. You revealed to us how we are to keep the Sabbath and so forth. But in spite of all of that, our fathers rejected you, hard their necks, didn't listen to your commandments, refused to obey, weren't mindful, verse 16 and following. But you are always ready to pardon, gracious, merciful, and so forth. Even when they made the golden calf and so forth, you didn't forsake them. So notice, even then, God had demonstrated a willingness to allow people space of time and opportunity to change and to repent. You sustained these people for 40 years in the wilderness, verse 21. And even through all of that, verse 26, they're still disobedient. They killed your prophets. They didn't do what you wanted them to do. They acted proudly, verse 29, didn't listen to your commandments, sinned against your judgments, and they shrugged their shoulders, stiffened their necks, wouldn't hear. All of this just demonstrates how the people in the past had been very, very much disregarding of who God was. All right, so this is chapter 9. This whole chapter talks not only historically about what God has done to help them, but also talks about the number of times that they had rebelled against God. So towards the end of that prayer, we note God's praise for his long-suffering, his mercies, patiently endures the people's sins, waiting for them to come back to him. Conclusion of the chapter states that these people were to enter into a covenant with God. Not a new covenant, but a renewal of the covenant. We see renewal of covenants multiple times through the text. Not starting something all over again, not saying that the covenant made with Abraham was null and void, or the law of Moses was null and void, but these new covenants are recommitments, rededications, reconfirmations of what they were always supposed to be. So as you read through that chapter, you're going to see a constant history lesson. God's always gracious. You're always failing. God's still gracious and allows you to come back from your fails and lets you start all over again. So this do-over is by no means the first of the do-overs. They continue to sin against God, but God was patient. Notice in this, in the notes, I make reference in the last part of it to a reference to the Sabbath. Verse 14, the chapter, is a good verse to remember when talking to anybody who thinks the Sabbath was a divinely ordained commandment, from the beginning of creation, and therefore binding since that time. This verse states that the law of Sabbath was only made known to the Jews when Moses was at Mount Sinai. So it was never intended to be a perpetually observed thing from the time of creation, the Garden of Eden, going forward. Chapter 10, the opening verses of the chapter list those who sealed the covenant mentioned in the closing verses of the preceding chapter. So there are lots of names that are mentioned, verses 1 and following. They put their seal on the document and then their names are given. That goes through verse 27 and so forth. And the priests are going to be brought up in verse 28 and following. The remaining part of the chapter tells us of the commands made by the rest of the people in the land. Some of those commitments were not to marry foreign people, not to buy on the Sabbath or any holy day, support the work of the temple, which includes supporting the priesthood, to provide wood for the offerings, the sacrifices, to give their first fruits at the beginning of the harvest, and generally speaking, not to forsake the house of the Lord in any way, which they are rebuilding and redoing, people building at this time, and not relying on the largesse of David and Solomon to do so. So, that's the first 27 verses, the list of the names, commitment by others in verses 28 and so forth. They entered into this oath to walk in God's law, which was given by Moses, the servant of God. So notice, 1,000 years before, still applies today. Constant drawing closer to the written word that had been in existence for all this time. Again, not being involved in marriages with others, not selling on the Sabbath. We're just hitting the highlights here, giving the first fruits, devote their firstborn of all things to the Lord. All right. Looking to see if there's anything else. Nothing else that I have to distinguish in the text that's separate from what we noticed in the survey of our Everyday with God notes. Chapter 11, the entire chapter simply details and lists the residents of Jerusalem and the surrounding cities and areas. So it says, verse 1, leaders of the people dwelt at Jerusalem. The rest of the people cast lots to bring 1 out of 10 to dwell in Jerusalem, the holy city, and 9/10 were to dwell in other cities. So the major city of Jerusalem, metropolitan center, so to speak, people would be living in the suburbs or the exurbs away from that. And so these are the people who were going to live in and around the city of Jerusalem at that time. And it lists them according to their tribal connection and family connection. All right, and that goes all the way through the rest of the chapter. Verses 25 and following talks about those who were living on the outskirts. Chapter 12, first 26 verses of the chapter lists the priests and the Levites who went up with Zerubbabel. Remember, he's the one who came back at the beginning, Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah. He's mentioned a couple of times in both Ezra and Nehemiah. These are the priests and the Levites who came up with Zerubbabel. And then their names are listed through verse 26. These lived in the days of Jehoiakim, the son of Jeshua, the son of Jozadak, and in the days of Nehemiah, the governor, and of Ezra, the priest, the scribe. So Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah, the three great leaders during this period of restoration, are all mentioned in the first 26 verses of the chapter. Verses 27 and following depicts the account of the dedication of the wall, not the completion of the wall, but the dedication of the wall of the city of Jerusalem, and the names of those who participated in that dedication. And then the last part of the chapter talks about the restoration of offices and duties in and around the temple proper. So again, first 26 verses, a list of names going back to Zerubbabel and others who came back, including Ezra and Nehemiah. Verse 27 and following, there's a dedication of the wall, we mentioned that, of the city of Jerusalem. They sought out the Levites to bring them to the city to dedicate it with gladness, thanksgiving, singing, and so forth. Verse 27, priests and the Levites purify themselves, purify the people, and they had two huge choirs, thanksgiving choirs, that were there on that occasion. The priest's sons with trumpets, their names are given in verse 35 and following. All those with musical instruments of David, the man of God, and Ezra the scribe went before them. So there's a huge celebration that takes place. The procession from the fountain gate going up the stairs of the city of David to the stairway and so forth. All that is mentioned as they're moving their way through the city with the people involved in the Thanksgiving. Great sacrifices, more rejoicing with all the men, women, and children that were there, and it was heard by all. Then verses 44 to the end, at the same time they were appointed over the rooms of the storehouse for the offerings, and then it talks about these individuals who were in charge of various parts of the temple complex itself. And notice it makes reference to David, twice at least, in verse 45 and verse 46. Remember, he's the one who created this work list of all the priests. And last verse, days of Zerubbabel and the days of Nehemiah, all Israel gave the portions for the singers and the gatekeepers, a portion for each day. So the point is, they are now supporting the work of the temple and the priests that had not been going on before. Chapter 13, the last chapter of the book of Nehemiah, is kind of different. Why is it kind of different? Because it talks about a huge mistake that needed to be addressed. When the law was read in the midst of the people, a passage was read indicating that the children of Israel were not to have Ammonite or Moabites come into the congregation of the Lord. Verse 3 tells us that when they heard this part of the law, they separated from themselves all of that mixed multitude. In the next few verses, verse 3 and following, you learn that one of the priests had prepared a chamber for Tobiah. But Tobiah was an Ammonite. And so what's the point? He's not supposed to be anywhere in the confines of the temple proper. And somebody allowed that to happen. Go back to chapter 2, verse 10. We see that Tobiah was introduced as an Ammonite. When Ezra came to the city of Jerusalem, he commanded that the chambers be cleansed, not just physically cleansed, but spiritually purified. In addition to that, Ezra learned that there were other discrepancies involved in the keeping of the temple, and all of these were brought to the attentions of the rulers the attention of the rulers. That's going to be noted in verses 11 and following. In addition to these matters, Ezra sought to straighten out problems concerning the selling and buying of food on the Sabbath, problems concerning the marriages to foreign women. All those are addressed in the latter part of the chapter. And the last few verses inform us that Ezra cleansed them from all the strangers and that he appointed the priest, everyone, to be involved in the specific business that they were assigned. So it says in verse 4, Eliashib, a priest, having authority over the storerooms, was allied with Tobiah. So there's a connection there. He prepared for Tobiah a large room where previously they stored grain, frankincense, articles, tithes of grain, and so forth. During all this time, I wasn't there in Jerusalem. From the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, I'd returned. After certain days, I obtained leave from the king, and I came to Jerusalem and discovered. So Nehemiah says, I wasn't part of this from the beginning. I found this out after I returned. Discovered the evil that Eliashib had done for Tobiah in preparing a room for him in the courts. Grieved me bitterly. Threw all that stuff out. Commanded them to cleanse the rooms. Again, not just physically, but ceremonially to do so. And I brought them back into them the articles of the house of God and the grain and the frankincense that was there. I also realized, this is multiple times we've seen this here, that the portions for the Levites hadn't been given them, weren't supporting the Levites. Why? People weren't being taught, or if they were taught, they weren't being obedient. And so that needed to be done. Why is the house of God forsaken? It's not saying it's fallen down, but you're not doing these things the way that they're supposed to be done. So he appointed treasurers, verse 13 and following, who are supposed to take care of these things. We noticed this before as part of the temple redo project, that monies were to be given into the temple for the support of the temple, repairs of the temple, and also the support of those who are functioning as priests. Verse 13 tells us about that. He prays, saying, God, don't wipe out all the good deeds that we've done for your house because of this mistake. Notice in verse 4, that's verse 14, verse 15, I saw in Judah some people treading wine presses on the Sabbath. They're not supposed to be doing a menial work like that, bringing in sheaves, loading donkeys and so forth, bringing it in the Sabbath day, and said, don't do that. Don't do that. There were men of Tyre who were there, not Jews, who were selling fish and all kinds of goods to the children of Judah on the Sabbath. So that's not what they were supposed to be doing. He contends with the nobles. Notice this is the second time, at least, that we've seen the nobles, the rich, had to be taken to task. What was the first problem? Taking advantage of the poor. What's the next problem? Selling when they ought not to be selling. What are you doing? You're profaning the Sabbath. Didn't your fathers do that and brought disaster upon themselves? So it was at the gates of Jerusalem, as it began to be dark on the Sabbath, they shut the gates so they couldn't do business there. Then I posted my servants at the gate so that no burdens would be brought in. Now, what's interesting is they started to sell their stuff right outside the walls, right outside the gates. Verse 20, all the merchants and sellers of all kinds of wares washed outside of Jerusalem once or twice. And I warned them, saying, why do you spend the night around the wall? If you do so again, I will lay hands on you. So it's not just don't do it in the city on the Sabbath. Don't do it on the Sabbath. Well, we'll fix the not do it on the Sabbath in the city. We'll get outside the city and do our business. We'll still meet people coming and going. No, don't do that. So he commanded the Levites that they should cleanse themselves, go and guard the gates to sanctify the Sabbath. Then the last verses 23 and following, I saw Jews who had married women of Ashdod, Ammon, Moab. Half of their children spoke the language of Ashdod, couldn't speak the language of Judah. Why? Because of the intermarriages. And evidently this had been going on for some time. I contended with them, cursed them and so forth, and said, don't be doing this. Don't give your daughters as wives to their sons and so forth. Don't take their daughters for yourself. Didn't Solomon sin by these things? That's what anticipated what preceded the division of the kingdom. Not the economics of the taxes, though that was brought out later, but the initial division was initiated by God because of Solomon's sins. So don't do that. He was a great king, but he sinned in this. And so pagan women caused even him to sin. Verse 26. Should we then hear of this, your great evil, doing the same thing? And so they made them correct this problem, cleanse them of everything pagan, and assign the duties that they were supposed to keep. All right, that takes us through the 13th chapter of the book of Nehemiah, which is the last chapter. Let's look at the review that we have in our class notes, or Everyday with God notes. Book of Nehemiah was initially joined together with the book of Ezra. We noticed that before in the Hebrew Old Testament. They were part of the same text. They were divided later. I'm thinking it was in the 4th or 5th century after the time of Christ. I believe that's the case. I'd have to double check that. But initially they were one. Both of the books are involved. Same general period of time. In fact, we see Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah names used in both of those texts. And in the midst of reading through Nehemiah, we saw great roles by Ezra. So they are living at the same time. These books cover the same period of time. Ezra mainly involves the rebuilding of the temple, and Nehemiah mainly involves the rebuilding of the city walls of Jerusalem. So one was primarily, though not exclusively, religious. The other one is primarily, though not exclusively, involved in civic matters. Must be mentioned that Nehemiah was just about the last historical figure to be addressed in the Old Testament. All the other materials subsequent to this book take place either contemporary with Nehemiah or prior to the time of the life of Nehemiah. So there's going to be a period of about 400 years between the Old Testament prophets and the coming of John the Baptist. Book of Nehemiah presents us with the last in a series of three stages of reform in the land of Palestine. One of the most important elements to be emphasized in this work and in Ezra is that God, though dissatisfied with the way that Judah conducted herself and therefore justified in sending the nation of Judah into captivity, as he had done to the nation of Israel 116 years before, God didn't give up on them. The recurring theme of the remnant is once more seen here. Some people will come back. As the people are to return to Jerusalem, first under the leadership of Zerubbabel, then under that of Ezra, and finally that under the direction of Nehemiah. So though his work is often described as mainly civic and political, must not overlook the spiritual foundation that was behind it. He was concerned about aberrations of the nobles twice, about doing business and taking advantage of others, doing business on the Sabbath, and taking advantage of those who were poor. That's not just a financial issue, that's a moral issue. They were adversely affecting the livelihood, the welfare of those who were less fortunate than they were. That's a spiritual, a moral thing, and not just a political one. So we don't want to overlook the spiritual foundation that was behind what Nehemiah did. Jerusalem was an incredible city of utmost importance in the Jewish way of life then, and still in large measure today, though different reasons. There's no temple as there was at that time. Place of political importance, but primarily it was a place of religious importance. It was there that the Temple of Solomon was built, not destroyed, but a second one is now built at that place. Religious life and worship of all the Jews revolved around that city. Nehemiah left the place at the king's side, Artaxerxes, to come to a land that God promised to return to the Jews if they would reform and restore what they were doing before. So Nehemiah's attitude is to be commended. How easy it would have been to remain in the king's service in comfort and to have everything he needed and just to forget about Israel. But his passion was for his people. And we saw before that he prayed and he fasted and cried out on their behalf and then asked if he could help. He asked the king if he could help, and the king allowed him to do so. So his attitude is very commendable. How easy it would have been for him to remain where he was, to forget about Israel. Nehemiah saw the plight of the Jews, concerned enough to get personally involved. The character of Nehemiah affords us with numerous examples worthy of imitation. One, intensely prayerful. Study the prayers in the book. Two, he was uncompromising, wasn't going to give in from challenges outside, that is by non-Jews, and wasn't going to give in by challenges inside by the nobles who had wealth and were taking advantage of others. Refused to be intimidated by the abuse that came from Sanballat, Tobiah, and others. When Sanballat sent numerous petitions encouraging him to meet, Nehemiah refused. I'm not going to leave the work that I'm doing. This is God's work. I'm not going to come down and talk to you. False prophet comes to urge him to seek the sanctuary in the temple. He refused to enter, even if it meant saving his own life, as it was being threatened. Not going to do that. Those are favorable attitudes on the part of Nehemiah, as well as anybody who would be God's. Nehemiah worked with the people. Not only did the people have a mind to work, so did Nehemiah. He was unselfish. He came to the aid of Israel. He did so without taking more than what he needed, though he could have taken more. He did not. Could have taken the bread of the governor, chapter 5, verse 14, but he only took what he needed. That's a personal example worth emulating. Because of that personal example in his life, he was better prepared to convince the nobles of the city to curtail their habits of charging excessive interest, usury, to their poorer brethren, taking advantage of them. Nehemiah did not command them to do something that he himself was not personally willing to do. And Nehemiah is not like the religious leaders that Jesus spoke of in Matthew 23, who told people to do all kinds of things but refused to do them themselves. Don't do that. Do as I say, not as I do. No, that doesn't fly. Do as I say, and I do the same thing. So he commended them to do what he was already willing to do. Also learned from the book of Nehemiah, as well as Ezra, the importance of the Old Testament law of Moses in the reform of Judaism as God wanted it. Several times within those books, large portions of space are devoted to an account of the reading of a law. Must remember that for all its intents and purposes, should not be saying intensive purposes, that's a bad way to word that, the law had almost faded from Israel prior to the time of their captivity, which is why they were sent into captivity, into exile. Several times among the kings of Judah, several times do we know that reforms were started of those aspects of the law which had not been kept since the times of the judges or the times of Samuel. Now, the law is being exalted to the position which it was always intended to occupy. God was keeping his promises to the Jews because now, finally, at last, they're keeping God's laws. Another important theme depicted in Nehemiah is the willingness of the people to acknowledge, to repent, and to confess their sins. When they were informed of them, even though it required a lot of sacrifice to do so, they gave those sinful practices up. We note that the people were misusing the Sabbath, but they corrected the matter. Learned that the people married foreign wives, but they corrected the matter. Told of the impurities of the priest, those matters were corrected. Such an example is important to us today. Another very important theme is seen here. Satan is not greatly concerned about a dead or degenerate church. It's the church on the wall of Zion with sword of trial set for the upbuilding and defense of the kingdom of God that causes satanic concern and stimulates active opposition. The point is, when they were actively doing something, Satan was that much more active in trying to keep them from doing that. So, when we, generally speaking, are loafing, avoiding the work we're commissioned to do, Satan's not concerned. Hey, they're not doing it. Don't have to make them do it. Not do it. They're already not doing it. So notice it wasn't until Nehemiah began to rally the Jews to build the wall that Sanballat and his companions began their campaign of constant criticism and condemnation. They seemed to be happy before because the temple had languished in its rebuilding for 20 years. And when Nehemiah came back, the walls were all knocked down. And that didn't bother them. So now that the process has started to re-engage and restart all of these things, now they're going to oppose. Through it all, there's an admonition, of course, to be faithful. That takes us through Ezra, Nehemiah. Let's look now at the book of Esther. Now, Esther is kind of an outlier, like the book of Ruth is an outlier. What do I mean? The book of Ruth, as we read, and if you go back to the opening verses of the book of Ruth, you see it starts in a very interesting way. So after we read through Joshua and Judges, and we come to the book of Ruth, it says, "It came to pass in the days when the judges ruled, that there was a famine in the land. And a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons." That's Elimelech and Naomi and the two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, who eventually marry the respective Moabite women, Orpah and Ruth. And what's the significance of this? I said it was an outlier because the book of Judges tells us what's going on within the confines of the borders of the kingdom of Israel. It's not a divided kingdom yet. It doesn't even have a king yet. There's no Saul, no Samuel, no David, no Solomon. So this takes place during the period of the Judges. But the story takes place at the beginning outside of the land, and then as they return to the city of Bethlehem. So there, we don't see the huge issues that we see facing the book of Judges in the book of Ruth, though it happens at the same time. The point here is that this is taking place in the general time period of the Persian and Median kings, the Medo-Persian Empire. So it's roughly the same historical period of the time that was discussed in Nehemiah and Ezra, but it's kind of an outlier thing. What do we mean by that? The work of Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah was focusing on the remnant who returned from what was the conquered land of Babylon, now under the rule of Cyrus initially, and then Darius later that, Artaxerxes, and about their return to the city of Jerusalem and rebuilding everything in and around Jerusalem and Judah. But that's not what's going on here, all right? So this takes place about the same historical period as do Nehemiah and Esther, but the location is different. While the previous two books focused on the returning exile, this book centers on the Jews who remained in the countries where they were initially held captive. So the book centers around the life of one of those Jews, a woman named Esther, and other family members, Mordecai, that comes to the fore in a little bit, who becomes queen of Persia and Media. And through her influence, she was able to avert the senseless slaying of the Jews in the provinces of the king. How does all that spell out? We find out as we go through the book. So chapter 1, opening verses of this chapter, which are, of course, the opening verses of the book, set the stage for the rest. King Ahasuerus began to conduct feasts for his princes and his nobles. At the same time, his queen Vashti made a feast for the women of the royal house. And the next section of the opening chapter, a king requests for Vashti to come and show her beauty to all the princes, and she refused to do so, and the king becomes angry. So the latter section of the chapter, the wise men and counselors of the king said, you need to depose her, get her out of there, get rid of her. And so he does that. He's advised to put Vashti away as the king's queen and to select another. That saying pleased him. You know, he wants to look good in the sight of all of his wise men and his nobles, so he consents to their advice. And these things were done, supposedly, to let every woman know her place. Listen, you let this out that the queen does this and doesn't get punished for it, all our wives are going to rebel. We won't talk anything about what it means to be politically correct today or what it was like to keep women under your thumb, but this is part of what was going on at that time. So the news of that decision is published throughout the provinces of the king. He's supposed to select somebody else to replace the woman who was Queen Vashti or Vashti. All right. Chapter 1. I'm not going to read everything. We've just done a quick overview. In the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia, over 127 provinces. So he's usually identified as Xerxes, X-E-R-X-E-S, Ahasuerus or Xerxes. He sits on the throne. Third year of his reign, he makes this great feast, and all the great servants and the powers of Persian Media, they all come together. He shows all of his great riches and his kingdom and whatever, has a 180-day long feast. That's a pretty big deal, 6 months long. So at the time of this feast and so forth that's going on, it describes all the accoutrements, all the white and the blue curtains and all the stuff, the fine linen, the purple rods, the marble pillars, couches of gold, just pretty, pretty fancy stuff. They served vessels in golden vessels, each vessel being different from one another, so they're all unique. Royal wine in abundance, just, you know, having a big time for such a long period of time. And so Vashti, the queen, makes a feast for the women. And on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, which indicates that he may have been under considerable influence, and he's there with all of these individuals, he wants Queen Vashti to come wearing her royal crown in order to show her beauty to the people and the officials, for she was beautiful to behold. But she refused to come at the king's command. You're not told why immediately. She refused to come at the king's command brought by his eunuchs. Therefore, the king was furious and his anger burned with him. So what was going on that this came about? Don't know the backstory, not in this point anyway. Then the king said to the wise men who understood the times, for this is the king's manner, told all who knew law and justice, those closest to him, they mentioned, what are we going to do? Because she didn't obey the command brought to her by the eunuchs. And so they said, well, she's wronged the king. She hadn't just wronged the king. She's wronged all the princes, and she's wronged all the people who are in the provinces of King Ahasuerus, which was 127. So this behavior is going to be known to all women, And they're all going to despise their husbands in their eyes when they hear about this report. Did you hear that King Ahasuerus demanded the queen come before him and she didn't come? This very day, the noble ladies of Persia and Media will say to all the king's officials, you know, we don't have to do that. And so, yeah, let's stop that before it gets too far. So let this decree go out. Let it be recorded in the laws of the Persians and the Medes that will not be altered, that she cannot come before him anymore, Ahasuerus. And let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she is. When the king's decree is going to be proclaimed throughout the empire, all 127 provinces, the wives are going to honor their husbands, both great and small. You let this go too far, and you're going to have rebellious women all over the place. And so the king said, okay, that sounds good. It pleased him, verse 21. He does according to all the word of his advisor, sends letters out and tells everybody this, every people in their own language, that each man should be master in his own house and speak in the language of his own people. All right, so chapter 2, and we need to go to chapter 3 to bring up for a reading, so we've got this and one more chapter to go. Chapter 2, after Vashti is deposed, dismissed, search begins for a young maiden who's going to take her place. Verses 1 through 18 talk about all the stuff that's going to go on to make sure that happens. Officers are appointed in the different provinces, again 127 of them all over the place, huge empire, to gather together all the fair young virgins to the palace of the king, and there the king is going to decide which one pleased him. So one of the maidens brought was Esther, and Esther was a Jew. Her mother and her father were dead, and she was raised by her relative Mordecai. She was instructed by Mordecai not to tell the king that she was a Jew. Remember, the Jews were part of many nations that were led captive initially into Babylon and now under the dominant influence of the Medes and the Persians. Don't tell her. So she didn't tell. All right. Verse 17, we find out that the king finds favor with Esther above all the women, and he's going to make her the queen. So a great feast is given in her honor. So that's part of the story. This story gets complicated as we continue. Last part of the chapter informs us of the fact that Mordecai, on one occasion, saved the life of the king from two men who sought to conspire against him. This was made known to the king by Esther. Men were found out, hanged, and the event was recorded in the records before the king. So we've got Esther rises in prominence and is going to become the next queen. And Mordecai does a good deed for the king and by saving his life by those who were conspiring against him. Each of these facts is going to come into play as we go a little bit further into the book of Esther. So, after all this, the hubbub of the first chapter subsides, he sends this decree out and so forth. It says, let all these young women be brought before the king, verses 2 and following. Let all the officers and all the provinces gather all these beautiful women and let them go through this whole beautification screening process. And all those details are spelled out in verses 3 and following, so that the young woman who pleases the king is going to be made queen. So in Shushan, the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. So he was of the same lineage as was Saul. Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives who had been captured with Jeconiah, king of Judah. That goes back into the period in which we read of these things, concluding chapters of kings especially, had been carried away, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. All right, so Nebuchadnezzar is no longer the king. Babylon's no longer the kingdom that's in ascendance. It's Medes and Persians who are in control, and Ahasuerus or Xerxes, who is the current king. But this goes back to when they were first carried away. Been carried away from Jerusalem during the time of Nebuchadnezzar. So Mordecai had brought up Hadassah. Her name is Hadassah, but she's often referred to as Esther. So Mordecai, in verse 7, brought up Esther, Hadassah, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother, right? The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So he's going to raise her. So she is part of the entourage of young virgins that brought before the king. And we see all the stuff that she is going to be found in his favor. She still hasn't revealed who she was, her people, or her kindred, because Mordecai said, verse 10, don't tell anybody. So every day Mordecai paced back and forth in front of the women's quarters, wanting to know what's going on. Each woman's turn and so forth is going to take place. And finally, it's going to get to the point where she's going to go in, verse 14 and following. The turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. So she's taken to King Ahasuerus, verse 16, into his royal palace in the 10th month. King loved Esther more than all the others. She's obtained grace and favor in the sight of all the others. And he puts the royal crown on her head. So the king makes a great feast, the Feast of Esther, for all his officials and servants, proclaims a holiday, and everybody gave gifts according to the generosity, and he gave gifts according to the generosity of a king. So the concluding verses, that's going to set the stage for something that's going to happen later. Esther hadn't revealed herself or her people, as Mordecai told them not to. In those days, while Mordecai was at the king's gate, two doorkeepers became furious and wanted to kill the king. Matter became known to Mordecai, who told Esther. Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name, and when an inquiry was made, it was confirmed, and those men were killed, and that was recorded. So that's the end of chapter 2. Now, what's the significance of that? Because Mordecai did a good turn, a good deed on behalf of the king, and Esther was involved in revealing that to the king, and nothing good happens to him as a result. So chapter 3 sets the stage for a major, major problem that's going to make everything much more complicated. So after those things, Ahasuerus, also known as Xerxes, promotes a man by the name of Haman, promotes him above all the princes that were in his court. So everybody pays their respects to Haman, bowed down before him, but Mordecai would not do so. As a result, Haman was very majorly ticked off, very annoyed, and he sought to do harm to Mordecai. Why? Everybody else bows down to me. Why don't you? So Haman went before the king. Now watch this. Haman went before the king and informed him not that Mordecai was different from everybody else, but that there was a people living in the land that had different laws than the rest of the people in the land, and they didn't keep the laws of the king. They were, therefore, not profitable for the king to allow these people to continue to remain. Haman then asked for the money to pay that these people might be destroyed. The king granted Haman the money and ordered a decree made and declared throughout the province of the kingdom. And the decree set the date for the destruction of this people. Who were they? The Jews. Esther was a Jew. Mordecai was a Jew. And so rather than showing his displeasure against one individual, Mordecai, Mr. Haman says, I'll get rid of all the Jews. And if I get rid of all the Jews and he's part of all the Jews, then he's going to be gone too. So we're not going to get to the solution or the resolution of this until we review these things in our next Lord's Day morning Bible study, which is going to be Sunday, June 14th. But let's set the stage for how complicated this is going to be by looking a little bit more closely in chapter 3. So Haman, son of Hammedatha, an Agagite, he's advanced above everybody else. All the king's servants who were within the king's gate, they bowed before him and they paid homage to him, for so the king commanded. But Mordecai wouldn't bow, wouldn't pay homage. And the king's servants who were with Mordecai in the gate said, why did you transgress the king's command? So it happened when they spoke to him daily and he would not listen to them, that they told it to Haman to see whether Mordecai's words would stand. For Mordecai had told them that he was a Jew. And so his reason for not showing such great deference to him was he was a Jew and going to honor some guy as if he were acting like a god. When Haman saw that Mordecai didn't bow or didn't pay him homage, Haman was filled with wrath. You know, this guy's not submitting to me. Got to do something. But he disdained, did not like the thought of laying hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him of the people of Mordecai. Instead, Haman sought to destroy, watch this, all the Jews. That's chapter 3, verse 6. All the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai. All right. So in the first month, which is the 12th, the month of Nisan, N-I-S-A-N, 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast pur, that is lots, before Haman to determine the day and the month until it fell in the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, now watch the plot here. There's a certain people, doesn't say who it is here, scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. That's interesting. So remember, the Jews were moved around by the Assyrians when the northern kingdom fell, scattered to the nations and took other nations that were defeated and scattered them and brought them back to the land that we know to be Samaria and Galilee later, Galilee of the Gentiles. And this refers to that. They're not only scattered and brought to Babylon, but they're scattered throughout the Medo-Persian Empire. So these people are dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. And so that could be just a generic, or it could be a literal, in that there were Jews scattered in all 127 provinces, which is not at all unlikely. They're different. How are they different? Their laws are different from all other peoples, and they don't keep the king's laws. Well, it's not a true statement they don't keep any of the king's laws, but there are some laws that they won't keep. So it's easy to segue from they don't keep one to they don't keep this one and this one. They don't keep all of your laws, which makes it sound like they don't keep any, which is not right. That's a satanic thing we saw in the beginning in Genesis chapter 3. They don't keep the king's laws. Therefore, it's not fitting for them to remain. So if the king is pleased by this, let's write this decree. And let's pay 10,000 of silver and from the king's treasury, and let's have people go out and kill them all. So the king, thinking this is a good thing, can't have all these rebellious people, takes a signet from his hand, gives it to Haman, and says, okay, here's the money. You make sure that this happens. So the king's scribes were called, 13th day of the first month, and a decree is written according to what Haman commanded. So he's got the blessing. He's acting under the auspices of King Ahasuerus or Xerxes. So he writes this letter, and he writes to the officials of all the people of every province according to its script. That is, it's written in the native tongue of the provinces to where it's being delivered. And to every people in their language, in the name of King Ahasuerus, here's what's written. They're sent by couriers in all the king's province to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, on the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, and take their possessions, plunder their possessions. So a copy of that document was issued as law in every province, being published for all people that they should be ready for that day. So the couriers went out, hastened by the king's command, and the decree was proclaimed in Shushan, the citadel, that is, in the palace. And so the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Shushan was perplexed. What in the world is all this about? All right, that brings us up to where we are supposed to be in our reading through Sunday, June the 7th. We finished our review of Ezra, the last two chapters, Sunday morning. We surveyed part of Nehemiah Sunday morning. The rest of it we just did as part of this setting, which again is for June 7th, Sunday evening session. Summed up Nehemiah, introduced Esther, and have gone through the first three chapters of Esther. So between now and next Sunday, which is going to be the 14th, we will finish the concluding chapters of Esther. That's chapters 4 through 10. So we've got seven chapters there. Conclude Esther and introduce and start our reading of the book of Job. So by the time we get to Job next week, we'll be up to about Job chapter 28. So we're moving into new material, not just new books, but new material from the standpoint of its genre. We're getting into the wisdom of literature of Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Solomon. And then towards the end of July, we'll get into the prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, and so forth. And it won't be till October. Imagine that. We're into the 10th month, and the first day when we finish, second day, look at it here, and we'll finish the Old Testament book of Malachi. So a lot more to go. We're not quite halfway done, but we're getting close to that. We'll be halfway by the end of June. Right, that concludes our summarization, our survey of every day with God through Esther chapter 3 for Sunday, June 7th, the PM setting.